This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Key to all of this has been making sure that local communities are involved and empowered within these areas. They are 99% of the solution or the problem, and so having them on board is absolutely critical to making these areas a success.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we dig into our archives to learn more about the activities of two nonprofits that focus on saving rainforests. Our first guest, Topher White, is making a difference using dormant cell phones. His organization, Rainforest Connection, upcycles defunct phones with solar charging technology and then places them strategically in rainforests all over the world to monitor human activity like poaching and deforestation. Then we hear from Paul Solomon, the CEO of the Rainforest Trust, as he talks about the organization's efforts to defend fragile ecosystems, the technologies they use to monitor the species they protect, and their methods for engaging indigenous peoples to ensure the preservation of vulnerable species. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Topher White. He is the founder and CEO of Rainforest Connection. Topher, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thanks a lot. It's great to be here on Sea Change.
So explain for our listeners in a nutshell, what is Rainforest Connection's mission? What do you guys do?
Rainforest Connection, we're trying to build technology that can help the world fight deforestation. And we find one of the best ways to do that is to really empower the people on the ground in the rainforest, those who would stop deforestation, illegal logging, illegal poaching, and those sorts of destruction, empower them with technology that we can build, you know, much more easily here in Silicon Valley, and then find ways to connect people here with people there to really make them aware of how important the work is that they're doing, and also to allow people here to get involved.
The kind of headline that a lot of people take away from learning about Rainforest Connection and your elevator pitch, I guess, to people who don't know it is usually that you convert these recycled cell phones into solar-powered listening devices, and then you use them in the rainforest. Walk us through the bare-bones technology, and then we'll dive into the details more.
Sure. So at its base, what we do is we put these listeners. It could be old cell phones, it could be other things that can run cell phone software. We put them up in the forest with solar panels so they can last a very long time. They listen to all the sounds of the forest, and they actually stream that up to our servers up on the internet in the cloud, where we can analyze it with all sorts of interesting techniques, including AI, including neural networks. And then we can actually send alerts to people on the ground who can show up and stop these things in real time. And the great thing about it is that there is cell phone service in a lot of the peripheries of these forests. A lot of these places that are under threat, there's actually cell phone service. So using old cell phones actually works. We can get the data out over these networks up into the cloud, and then we can send alerts over those same networks back to the people there who would be able to stop it. And it's not just about chainsaws and logging trucks and things like that. We can pick these things out, but it turns out that with all the advanced techniques that we have available up on the cloud, we're able to pick out different species, we're able to analyze it, and we're able to make all sorts of new tools available to the general public, including the ability to just listen to the sounds of the forest. So we really think that taking this magical place that is the forest, helping people there protect it on the ground, and also opening it up to people around the world, we think that's a really important part of the overall solution.
Well, my big takeaway from that is, how do they possibly have cell phone reception in rainforests when I can't even get cell phone reception in the two closest grocery stores to my house in San Francisco?
Well, it's true. Sometimes you have the same problems back in the Bay Area, but basically all over the country. And the truth is that there's a lot of the forest, obviously, that doesn't have cell phone service. But a lot of these networks, they're made to work in these pretty remote places, and cell phone service may not be always that great in the United States. But out in these remote places, it's the only way for people to connect, and so they tend to make the networks pretty strong. But these networks aren't great. That's why we have to climb pretty high in trees. So we actually go sometimes 100, 150 feet up in trees to get the best access to sun, to get the best access to solar, to cell phone networks. Chances are in the store you might not get it, but if you were able to climb to the top of a telephone pole, you might be just fine. And that's kind of the principle that we use in the forest as well.
So what kind of cell phones are ideal for your listening devices? And maybe explain kind of what data you're gathering.
Yeah, so we're actually gathering all sorts of information, but the most amazing stuff you can pull out of the forest is sound. So the forest sounds amazing. It's just such a cacophony of noise from one moment to the next, and it changes from hour to hour, minute to minute. And so that's why we think audio is actually the most rich thing we can pull out of it. And if we can get that audio out up into the cloud, we can pull lots of interesting insights out. But of course, we're also gathering other information, not only about the devices we put up, but about the environment. And of course, phones have cameras as well, but usually up high in trees, all you can really see are other trees. But yeah, the good thing about audio is that you can hear stuff that's happening pretty far away. So that's why we really focus on it. If a truck comes by or a chainsaw goes off, even within 1 kilometer of where we had installed one of these devices, then we're really, really able to pick it out of the sounds of the forest. And that's not something that people can do because the forest is very loud, but a computer is pretty good at picking it out. And the really cool thing is that sort of constant cacophony of noise, also little perturbations and changes that are within it, because again, these are animals who are there and animals react to things. Those are things we can use to help determine what's happening in the forest as well over time as we learn more about it. And that's not just coming from us, it's coming from ecologists and biologists who can use our data set to study the forest and tools we build to empower them to do so. You ask about what kind of phones. Android phones are actually what we put up in the forest. And while a lot of the phones that come to us as donations, we just get too many donations to actually put up in trees, because the truth is that one phone can cover a pretty big area. But we tend to give them to the rangers as well. So a lot of the times that phones get sent to us, we give those into the hands of rangers, who then can use other software that we write to be able to react in real time.
So what was the inspiration behind this Topher?
So my background is much more in physics and software engineering rather than environmentalism. This sort of came across by accident. I was very fortunate to be volunteering at a gibbon reserve out in Indonesia while I was actually working in physics back in France. But I took a vacation in Indonesia to volunteer and realized that this one gibbon reserve who was trying to really rehabilitate gibbons, which are large apes, release them back into the wild, they were spending a decent amount of their time and resources trying to stop illegal logging that was happening around the sanctuary. And this just seemed very unfair to me, that they were having to send people off in the forest to go pick up chainsaws that were being fired off just a few kilometers away, or even just less than a kilometer away. I figured this was something that the computers should be able to do. And there was no electricity, no running water, no roads, none of that stuff. But there was cell phone service way off there in the middle of the forest. And so I figured I could use one of these old phones that we had there to hack together an app that could pick it out. Turns out it was more difficult than that. But at the same time, not too much later, I went back there and tested the system made out of old cell phones and was able to prove they could pick up illegal logging and head off and actually stop them in the act. And in the process, I learned more about deforestation and learned that deforestation is the second largest contributor to climate change. All this time, I thought it was just about energy, which is why I was working on nuclear fusion in France and a few other things, because I really wanted to have an effect on that. But to learn that deforestation is the second largest contributor to climate change and more than all the transportation put together, and that there were people out there who could have a really outsized effect on stopping it, these rangers in the field. If I was going to be able to build technology and there was a fairly simple solution that could be even just minorly useful to them, that was really something that I wanted to do. And it turns out that that's been effective so far.
And what countries are we talking about here? I know you're in Sumatra, but you're expanding. And although the rainforests are shrinking in terms of their footprint, the footprint of Rainforest Connection is expanding, it sounds like.
Well, we hope that we can expand to enough areas that could make use of the technology. It's true we started in Sumatra, and we really hope to have a bigger presence there. And we've also had presence in Africa, but most of our projects, our most active projects right now, at the moment, are in Brazil, Ecuador, and Peru, with projects on the horizon in Bolivia, Nicaragua, and then, of course, back in Africa and Indonesia. So in our case, about half the forest remains today since the beginning. We think that we have a chance to sort of reverse that trend, particularly because a lot of the forest that does remain is on the periphery. It's bad news for the forest that so much of it has been fragmented, but it's good news if you feel that the people who are on those fragmented areas, those periphery areas, those are the ones who would have the best chance of stopping it. And so we're trying to build a system that overall empowers those people on the edges and also gives them access to technology, and also credit for making those positive changes from the rest of the world. And we feel like we're building a system that can facilitate that.
And explain the back end, the system that you're describing.
Really, we talk a lot about these phones that go up in trees or you know, these devices that go up in trees, but really the magic, the really cool stuff is what happens on the back end. If you can build a system like we have to help get the data out of the forest, and once it gets there, then it becomes organized and you can analyze it for anything you want. And, you know, in our system, we're trying to make it possible for data to be extracted at very different points by governments, by NGOs, by the general public, by anyone who's interested, by scientists, by ecologists. That's a really important part of our mission, is to make this data available to them and also to archive it.
Maybe you can give us an example of some of the data that you've broken down and how it's been put into action to help an area.
Sure. So as the audio comes out from these phones, it goes up to the cloud, we'll analyze it for all sorts of things, not just chainsaws, but sometimes just vehicles. So in one particular case, we're working with a tribe in Brazil, the Tembe tribe. And one of their biggest issues is that, you know, when we began working with them, almost 80% of their land was actually controlled by illegal loggers, by illegal settlers, by illegal poachers. And for them, they had the rangers in place. They put together a force that was going to retake that land from the settlers and then resettle it with Tembe people. And that's, of course, very important because, you know, when the Tembe have control over their land, they make sure it stays forested, they make sure it stays healthy. You know, obviously, when a family gets resettled in a new area, it's very much under threat. And so when we work with the Tembe, you know, a lot of it's about making sure that the borders that are maintained by them, when they retake an area, they know when motorcycles come back over, when vehicles come back over from the opposing side, both to set fires, to do kidnappings and the rest. And so the Tembe use our system not to pick out chainsaws all the time. Sometimes it's about actually knowing an early response so the families in these newly settled areas can fall back when a raiding party is coming back over the line. And that's been used in at least one instance with the Tembe, and we hope quite a few more as they take more land.
He's the founder and CEO of Rainforest Connection, Topher White. Topher, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
I don't know what to say about it when all your ears have turned away. But now's the time to look and look again at what you see. Is that the way it all stays? That's the way it ought to be. Oh, don't you know that?
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dr. Paul Solomon. He's the CEO of Rainforest Trust. Paul, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks very much. It was great to be here with you, Alex.
For folks who don't know what the Rainforest Trust is, maybe you could give us a little background on the organization. It hasn't always been called the Rainforest Trust, has it?
That's correct. We were formed in 1988 to help establish protected areas across the tropics. We were formerly World Land Trust, US, and 3 years ago we changed our name to Rainforest Trust, given that we focused almost exclusively on protecting the most endangered rainforests for species at risk of extinction throughout the tropics. And so over the last 27 years, we've helped protect over 15 million acres of really crucial habitat for the most endangered species. And that has been our focus for the last 27 years. We've continued to make sure that our mission has not changed and is key to everything we do.
And let's dive into some of the work that you and your colleagues have been involved in recently. It's not all rainforest, despite the name Rainforest Trust. Why don't you first tell us about the work that you and your colleagues have been doing in Nepal in protecting the red panda there?
Sure. So the core of our mission is to try to focus on saving the most endangered species in the tropics. And invariably, some of those species aren't just in rainforest. They occur in, for example, the cloud forests of the Himalayas, or they may occur in the savannas of the Pantanal and wetlands in say, for example, Brazil or Argentina. We try to make sure that our efforts are pinpointed on the ground with tangible actions. In the case of the red panda, this is a species that is at great risk from poaching and from a lack of habitat loss. So key to our work has been to establish a network of protected areas in its core range, and working with local people, people that would otherwise poach or damage the habitat of the species. We work with these people to help protect the panda and provide alternative incomes. And so core to our project in Nepal has been this establishment with communities, setting aside areas of forest for the red panda, and in return, providing them with support and capacity to protect the area and reap other benefits that don't involve harming the species or clearing the forests.
I imagine that some of the challenges you face as an organization is working with different governments, especially when you're talking about a large landmass that you're trying to set aside to preserve a species. If this landmass either borders on other nations or crosses into other nations. You operate in Africa and South America, and obviously there's going to be some butting of heads.
Yeah, definitely. It is a great challenge. There's a huge number of pressures on the limited natural resources on our planet, whether it be simply timber or whether it be mining or farming, encroachment, things like that. There's a lot of pressures on the last wild places and intact habitats on our planet. And it is a real challenge sometimes to convince authorities, particularly national governments, that there are special areas that are really important for wildlife that we need to set aside. You need to leave a legacy that if we don't salvage, protect these areas now, they will be lost forever. So, for example, in Peru, we had a huge project there to create a new national park called Sierra de Divisor. It ran along the border with Brazil. Although it was only in Peru, there were tremendous pressures from Brazil that wanted to run roads into this wilderness area of Peru to basically have access to the resources in Peru and export them through Brazil. So creating a national park and shutting down the border with Brazil in a very key area was crucial, not just to protecting the national park, which itself was 3 million acres, but protecting tens of millions of acres of rainforest. And as important, the indigenous communities that occupied that area. Some of them haven't even been contacted before. They live in voluntary isolation. And so it's been really important working with the government, working with local organizations and entities. But at the end of the day, it wasn't Rainforest Trust, it wasn't, foreign governments. It was actually the indigenous communities in the area rallied to what we were trying to do. They realized how important it was, and they convinced the government that this was the right thing to do. And thanks to the indigenous communities, they have set aside a vast area. They have assured that the natural resources in Peru remain Peruvian, and that indigenous communities themselves, their lands will be recognized adjacent to this new national park. And so we're continuing to do that work with indigenous communities, build capacity, empower them, and make sure that any future threats that confront them, they will be confronted by a powerful and well-organized indigenous community.
And when natural resources come into play, and there is infighting over, let's say, logging rights or oil rights, how can a relatively small organization like Rainforest Trust stand up to some of these deep moneyed interests like Exxon, Chevron, or a big logging company or a government? How do you find allies in your struggle?
Well, we have yet to actually go head-to-heads with any of the major oil companies. I think what we're trying to focus on is not lobbying or confrontation. We're trying to focus on the ground, positive steps forward. And there is nothing more positive than building consensus and support within local communities by local conservationists. And people see the value in having something for a future for their children and their children's children. And even politicians get this. And if we are strategic and we focus on the areas that really need the help, obviously we're not going to save every last tree on the planet, but we are going to target the areas that are really crucial for communities and for biodiversity. I believe that we can really make a difference. And we are, and that's what Rainforest Trust is doing. We are working in specific sites, tangible areas, having concrete results. We're able to show every acre that we protect, and we're able to show that every community embraces these and continues to support them. Invariably, there are forests being lost every day, and that will continue to be a challenge, but I think that it's important to be positive and know that we can still make a difference and still salvage the most important areas.
I see the shapes I remember from maps. I see the shoreline. I see the white caps, a baseball diamond. Nice weather down there. I see the school and the houses where the kids are. Places to park by the factories and restaurants and bars for later in the evening.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Dr. Paul Solomon. He's the CEO of Rainforest Trust. So, Paul, can you give us some specific examples of animals that have responded well to Rainforest Trust conservation efforts?
Absolutely. Well, one of the best examples was a project that I was involved with for the last 18 years, and that was to protect the yellow-eared parrot, which was a critically endangered macaw-sized parrot in Colombia. That species was down to 81 individuals. Much like kind of the passenger pigeon, it was once a superabundant bird across the Andes of Colombia, and had plummeted to just one last population, and it was crashing. The population is crashing. Then I was a student.
You're a trained ornithologist, right?
That's correct. I was motivated and enthused from the age of 8 to protect tropical places. I was very lucky. I met Sir David Attenborough when I was 8 years old. He had just come back from Rwanda, having been with the mountain gorillas, and he was so excited, and it was so infectious. I think I caught that bug, and I continue to this day to do what he had evangelized to me. And so, having been trained with a background in ornithology, and having found the last population of this particular parrot, this was back in 1999, we have moved to protect its habitat, work with local communities, and they have totally embraced that this was a special species. They had no idea that it was only found in these last areas and that this was so special for them. They totally got behind the species, and thanks to their work and local conservationists, we were able to protect the species. And today, we've lost count. There's over 2,000 individuals today. And I believe firmly, and this is shown time and time again, when we give nature a space to thrive, when we give them protection, a nature reserve, a park or whatever, they will thrive. They will bounce back. They will, you know, jump at the chance, and we don't have to do anything. We didn't have to put them in a zoo. We didn't have to put them in a cage. They did it themselves. We just got to allow them the room to do it.
So, Paul, maybe you can speak towards some of the technological innovations that you and your colleagues use when you're trying to keep track of some of these animals. A lot of us have seen on nature shows critter cams and camera traps and things like that, but also drones have now kind of come into the picture.
That's right. I think that the challenges that we face, we're trying to embrace all of technology to help us. Certainly there's, you know, free and accessible tools like Google Earth that have updated high resolution imagery down to centimeters. You can see large chunks of the planet, and there's almost updated now on a monthly basis, so we can see if people are clearing forest near our protected areas. We can alert our conservation partners on the ground. We can mobilize the teams of local communities that are supporting the protection of these areas. We also have deployed drones to survey areas in more remote areas. It's just a good use of the limited resources that we have to survey areas and assess what is going on the ground. We try to avoid, expensive, vehicles and things like that, things that could get broken and cost a lot. We'd rather focus on small technology, things like camera traps, the trail cameras we use for, that hunters use in the US. Those deployed across reserves are invaluable. It's a way of monitoring the wildlife, jaguars and tapirs and things like that, that are walking the trails in our protected areas. But it also is a way of checking that there's not hunters walking through areas, or that people aren't going in and trying to take out wood. I mean, there's lots of different little innovative technology that we're using with our partners, we're training them on, and it just ensures that at the end of the day that the areas we protect remain in perpetuity in protection. It's so important. And I think it's also the real key to all of this has been making sure that local communities are involved and empowered within these areas. They are 99% of the solution or the problem, and so having them on board is absolutely critical to making these areas a success.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Dr. Paul Solomon. He's the CEO of Rainforest Trust. Talking about some of these innovations and technologies that allow you to track animals and survey the land that you're setting aside for them, where are the biggest needs for your organization in terms of resources? If somebody decided to give money to your organization, where should they expect it to go?
Sure. Well, we're really proud that we've stuck to our principles of getting as much funding on the ground as possible. And these projects are growing and growing. We've got more and more attention from local conservationists that have got great ideas. They've got motivation. They're totally dedicated and passionate in what they want to do, but they lack the resources to scale up and get these areas set aside as protection, whether it be land purchase compensating folks for local land that can be put into nature reserves, or whether it be working with local communities to plan for and establish national parks or national sanctuaries, wildlife reserves. It all takes funding to organize and coordinate on the ground. And so that's where our dedicated supporters have been so important. Providing the funding to make these projects happen has really made a difference.
He's the CEO of Rainforest Trust, Dr. Paul Solomon. Paul, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex. It was great to talk to you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Meters, Led Zeppelin, and Talking Heads. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.